ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Medialand, your weekly look at what's happening behind the scenes and on your screens. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Vivian Kelly.
Now, can you believe it's been more than 10 years now since Netflix and Stan launched in Australia and changed TV forever? Now, as Max threatens to shake things up again when it launches locally on Monday, we'll look at the state of streaming.
And the year's first radio ratings tell us a bit about whether the ABC's controversial lineup shakeups paid off.
First, though, Viv, one of the odder media stories of the week, a journalist getting his hands on war plans thanks to a group chat stuff up.
The internet seems a little bit divided, Tim, on whether this is hilarious or horrifying.
Why can't it be both, Viv? So this all kicked off about a fortnight ago. The Atlantic's editor, Jeffrey Goldberg, was added to a signal group by the US National Security Advisor, Michael Waltz. For people who don't use Signal, it's a messaging app, which is perhaps a little bit better than most at protecting security if you use it properly. So this group included a bunch of high-ranking officials, and it was set up ahead of an airstrike in Yemen. As Goldberg told his colleague, Hannah Rosen, on Radio Atlantic, at first he was worried that maybe he was being set up.
I mean, honestly, the first thing I thought was, I'm really being spoofed. Like, somebody is... This is a hoax. This is a state or non-state actor, probably non-state actor, looking to entrap, embarrass, whatever word you want to use, a journalist. This is nuts. I mean, obviously, why would I be involved in this?
Eventually, though, when the attack actually happened, he realized it was real.
Yeah, so he's talked about how he was sitting in his car in Salzburg in Austria when this sort of started going on, and he had about 2 hours' notice before the bombs were going to drop. And so when they dropped and when it became mainstream news that these targeted attacks had happened, the reality of what unfolded in the world confirmed it was real, and then so did the National Security Council, who said, this appears to be an authentic message chain, and we are reviewing how an inadvertent number was added to the chain. So from a journalist perspective, he had all the confirmation he needed that these were indeed the people that they appeared to be. And so he ran the headline in The Atlantic, "The Trump administration accidentally texted me its war plans." That does what it says on the tin. The Trump administration did accidentally text Jeffrey their war plans.
And I guess the question is, there are almost two stages to a story like this. Is that there's the verify it, be confident it's true, and then comes the question, should you use that information? Should you publish it?
Jeffrey has spoken quite extensively about how he internally grappled with this. So far, he's been quite coy about the conversations he had with colleagues. He was also obviously grappling with the legal implications of reporting on something of such national significance. There's security implications, there's privacy implications. At first, he and The Atlantic didn't publish the full details of what was in the text, which included weapons sequencing, timings of the attacks, details about targets, even details of some security personnel within the US system.
I mean, and I'm sure there are journalists who out there who disagree with my view, who take a kind of, I would call it nihilistic view, which is like, information is information, or we should just put it all out there and damn right. The torpedoes. That's not my thing.
Yeah, I guess what Jeffrey's explaining there is they're not WikiLeaks, which just dumps all information onto the internet for people to see. Him and The Atlantic were curating the information as part of their role that they see, which is partly to report the truth, obviously, but partly to protect national interests, protect the lives of serving American people overseas. Once, though, the Trump administration started denying that this was classified information or that any mistake had been made on their part by adding a journalist to a group chat, they obviously decided, well, okay, we need to show the full extent of why this is important. We need to demonstrate to the public that actually this is a massive deal. So then they published the full texts. The only thing redacted was one person's name, but everything else, emojis and all, strategy and all, was laid out for everybody to see in the follow-up article.
Well, Viv, I suppose most journalists at some point have been accidentally forwarded something. Have you ever been the accidental recipient of something you shouldn't have been?
Nothing on this scale. I did have something back in 2017, though, where I was reporting on this very organisation and an incident between ABC TV and ABC Radio, where I made an inquiry about it as a journalist, and Gavin Morris, the head of news at the time at the ABC, responded to me with an email about me.
That and must have been very useful feedback.
Look, it wasn't super flattering, but it was not difficult to verify either. I didn't have to wait for the White House to tell me that he meant what he said.
Well, it's a good lesson to always look twice before hitting send.
It sure is, Tim. Now, one of the other big news items this week is the radio ratings have emerged.
Finally.
Well,
it's been 3 long months.
You say finally, but one of the most unique things about radio is that it's publicly assessed with a readily available scorecard 8 times a year. So the first one of those from GFK are out now. And there's a few things in there that interested me. Firstly, there was obviously a lot of chatter last year when 702 ABC Sydney replaced its morning's host, Sarah McDonald. And then it emerged that Hamish McDonald would be taking on that role. A lot of listeners were quite upset with the way that unfolded.
It was a bit of a surprise at the time.
Yeah, and there was obviously a lot of listener loyalty to Sarah McDonald, and it was nothing against Hamish. It was more they loved Sarah and her show, and they were upset that it had happened. In terms of real-world impacts for ratings, that listener discontent doesn't seem to have translated. The morning show on ABC Sydney has gone from 6.2% to 6.4%.
So they've got a new favourite McDonald.
Well, I'd say that's just, you'd read that as largely flat. A 0.2% change is an increase, but for all intents and purposes, they've remained flat. I think that's probably a good thing from the ABC's perspective. Less great from the ABC's perspective, I guess, is ABC Melbourne Breakfast, which was at 6.3% of the audience share. So that was down. Worth noting, though, that former host Sammy J would probably be happy. That's still above Kyle and Jackie O, who are a Sydney-based breakfast show, but are now being syndicated into Melbourne.
And not doing terribly well in Melbourne even now.
Well, no, they're not. They have a 5.1% share in Melbourne, which, to contrast, they have a 13.3% share in Sydney. So still dominant in the FM market in Sydney, but struggling to cut through in Melbourne, where the number one FM breakfast show is Christian O'Connell on Gold, and he has an 11.5% share.
And saw a big jump to get there.
Yeah, up from 8.7%, which is quite significant. And I guess the other reason that could be significant is that's the same parent company that runs the KIIS Network, which has syndicated Kyle and Jackie O into Melbourne.
So do you think we might see Christian in Sydney then?
Well, people said if anyone can make it work in terms of syndication, it's Kyle and Jackie O, on the understanding that they are just so enduringly popular in Sydney. People do think the other person who could potentially make that work is Christian O'Connell. That would involve him replacing Jonesy and Amanda in Sydney, another really popular radio duo though. So it's a great thing for him that his ratings have gone up if he wants a national program, but he would be facing having to cut some really popular presenters.
For me, I suppose if I had to kind of pick the biggest set of bad news when these ratings dropped on Thursday morning, the worst breakfast time ratings in the history of ABC Radio National. We definitely have seen changing habits, certainly over the last 5 years or more. If you look at sort of across the five cities, then Radio National breakfast in the same period 5 years ago was averaging more across the five cities, more than 100,000 people. Now it's only a little bit more than 30,000, and that's across the five capital cities.
When you say it's the worst in recorded history, what do you think is driving that?
Yeah, look, one of the challenges is marketing. The commercial radio networks, and that's who the ABC is up against, can justify spending a lot of marketing because bigger audience means bigger advertising revenue. It's very hard to justify spending that same amount of marketing if you're the ABC when you could be spending it on making shows. But the problem is, if you don't tell people about the show, how do they find it?
Well, it's an interesting state of things for radio, Tim, and TV as well. As you know, it's been a decade since the streaming wars kicked off. So next we'll look at how Max will enter the battle.
You're listening to Medialand on ABC Radio National. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Vivian Kelly.
We've just hit the 10-year anniversary of Netflix and Stan launching in Australia. And the battle lines will change again on Monday when Max launches locally. Now, Max is owned by Warner Brothers Discovery, and that will be the future home of all those big-name HBO shows like White Lotus or Game of Thrones.
Max joins a market that's much more crowded than it was in 2015 when Netflix joined. But Netflix still reigns supreme in the space, causing, you could say, headaches for Australian network broadcasters and newer global players.
And also headaches for our wallets as well. Not many of us can afford all of the services. And we've seen the introduction of cheaper tiers with ads on them more recently as it becomes more and more like traditional television. And that switch to streamed video has been hurting the business model of the local commercial free-to-air players and what they can spend on making content. So what does that all mean for homegrown content?
Dr. Alexa Scalata is a lecturer in digital communication at RMIT University and co-leads SIGN, Streaming Industry and Genres Network. Welcome, Alexa.
Thank you for having me, Tim and Vivian.
So you've put out a report on the Netflix decade. There's probably a lot to take in there, given that I think Netflix used to be a DVD company. So what are the key takeaways of the decade that was for Netflix?
There sure was a lot to unpick. Some key takeaways from this decade is that obviously Australians have taken to streaming with gusto. In 2015, when Netflix and Stan kicked off what the media quickly dubbed a streaming war, the industry speculated that there would only be room for two streaming services, Netflix and one other. We thought Australia is very small, not that much room. And instead, this time last year, ACMA found that nearly half of us, 42%, are using more than five services. So we're now dealing with a fragmented, competitive landscape. We've got the big generalist services like Netflix, Prime Video and Disney Plus that are going head-to-head for exclusive content. And then we have some niche genre players as well, like Shudder for horror and HeyU for reality TV lovers that have been able to endure for a really long time because they cater to a specific audience segment and they keep their price point really low. So essentially more choice than ever before.
There was a time, Alexa, when there was appointment television for free-to-air commercial broadcasters. People would have to see the next episode of Desperate Housewives when Channel 7 broadcast it, or Grey's Anatomy, or Lost. That appointment television then disappeared for quite a while, where people could watch what they want when they wanted. You've mentioned choice. It was seen as a democratization of content. That appointment television seems to be back a bit now, with people going to streamers at a certain time to watch The White Lotus, for example, so that it isn't spoiled online later. So what impact have these streamers had on traditional television broadcasters? Because it feels like at first they killed appointment television and then they sort of made it their own thing.
That's right. The rhetoric around the arrival of subscription video on demand was that this was the ideal way to watch. You know, we departed away from having to be in front of the TV at a certain time, and we could watch whenever we liked and pretty much whatever we liked, and that content was more personalised. The impact on television broadcasters has been, especially the commercial broadcasters, has been pretty catastrophic. They've faced plummeting audiences and ad rates and revenues. For the first time, the number of Australian adults watching terrestrial broadcast free-to-air TV dropped to less than half for the first time last year. But that said, audiences are increasingly accessing free-to-air TV broadcaster video on demand platforms like 7plus and 9Now. They're not necessarily watching them as much as they used to watch free-to-air terrestrial TV, but this has become a really interesting space and increasingly a place where Australians are going to watch live TV, going to get the live stream through an app because of the take up of smart TVs and connected TV devices, but also because increasingly homes are not being built with aerials. So the only way into free-to-air TV is through those apps now. Even though the arrival of streaming promised this fantastic new way to watch, what we've actually seen is more continuity and more kind of a return to linear recently than we would have expected. A lot of the streamers, like you mentioned, Netflix certainly introduced that drop a season all at once model and that binge model, but some streamers like Apple TV Plus maintain that weekly drop to build anticipation, to keep people signed up for as long as possible. And so we're seeing that watching at a certain time returning. People are also not hating it. It gives us an opportunity to think about a show for a week, to be able to talk about it, to know that others are watching it along with you at the same time. So that's a really interesting development. And we're also seeing a kind of breakdown of Netflix famously said in 2016 that they weren't interested in live sports, for example. And now we've seen them do this huge deal with the wrestling. Lots of the streamers starting to buy into live sports. So that distinction between non-linear on streaming and linear on free-to-air TV is really breaking down, and we're getting both options in a lot of places now.
And of course, that's the same Netflix that also said it wasn't interested in ads until it started taking ads
exactly.
as well.
Indeed.
Now, a lot of the programs that we've mentioned, Alexa, are American. In terms mm-hmm. of when people are talking about the power of streaming, at the moment they would probably cite The White Lotus. They might cite sure. Severance as shows that people watch and talk about and sort of take over the conversation. We have Max arriving shortly in Australia, another streaming service which will carry very high profile, very popular American shows. Is it going to have any impact, though, on local Australian-made content?
That's a great question and a complicated one. So despite the fact that we've just celebrated Netflix's 10th birthday, the streaming services in Australia remain unregulated. We've had 8 official inquiries addressing whether and how digital platforms should be regulated, and the overwhelming kind of response has been that they should and that they need to, but it's produced no concrete reform. The federal government's cultural policy that came out in 2023 firmly kind of committed to some form of regulation, and some kind of formal regulation was promised to be introduced in the middle of last year. Unfortunately, that kind of date came and went, but I did notice that in Capital Brief a couple of days ago suggested that the government will return to this idea in the coming year.
One of the possibilities that's being talked about is similar idea to the obligations of the free-to-air players, content quotas. Jackie mm-hmm. Lambie brought this up in Senate Question Time.
In Europe and in Canada, they put local content quotas on streaming platforms. Guess what? Netflix is still there. They didn't leave. The world is still going around. According to the Australian Financial Review, Australians spent $3.5 billion on streaming subscriptions, but are getting nothing back for our own screen stories.
So, Alexa, one thing that strikes me about this idea of content quotas was for a while the free-to-air players quite liked that idea because level playing field for everyone. Why should we have it and not them? And then it suddenly occurred that that would probably drive up production costs for them as well because it's a market. And suddenly they lost interest. They lobbied the government to not do it after all. It strikes me that if there was a loser in that, it was consumers, the public.
Absolutely. The early discussion about a 30% quota, akin to what Europe's done, you know, ensure that 30% of the Netflix catalogue, for example, is Australian. That was the initial discussion. You know, would that work in Australia? Probably not, because unlike Europe, we don't have a huge catalogue to choose from, and it would really impact the size of the quota that we would, the catalogue that we would be able to access. So instead, it shifted a little bit to an expenditure quota, much like is imposed upon Foxtel's drama channels. So So in the meantime, while we've been discussing how to regulate the streaming services, what's actually ended up happening is the commercial broadcasters have lobbied quite successfully for further deregulation. And so as a result of COVID especially, we've seen a kind of flexibility allowed for them to meet the quota obligations that have been imposed upon them. And that has had devastating impacts on our local production sector, especially on the production of kids' content and on drama.
Well, maybe just on that point on kids' content, because wasn't that quite short-sighted of the TV networks to lobby to not have those quotas? Because the people who are now not watching free-to-air television are young people who maybe would have had their habits built if there'd been content made for them in the first place.
Yeah, that's a great point. I guess one of the issues that we at Sign have been dealing with, some of our researchers are specifically focused on kids' content and have done some incredibly interesting research with kids, their parents, and kind of watched kids navigate the video on demand landscape. One of the things that has come out from my colleague Jess Blentategi's research in particular is a lack of cultural literacy in children when it comes to determining and distinguishing between Australian kids' content and American kids' content. Some of the kids she spoke to would speak kind of ad nauseum about how much they love Investigators and Little Lunch and how these are such high-quality shows because they're American. But when they were told that they were in fact Australian, the response was kind of, what? The only shows that they could identify on video on demand platforms as being Australian were those titles with kangaroos or koalas in the pictures in the tiles. So we're already seeing a kind of breakdown of cultural literacy in children when they're using platforms like ABC iView and YouTube Kids and not being able to even identify the clear value that they see in that content.
One of the things that Senator Jackie Lambie was upset about in particular was that Australian children could end up walking around with American accents because they're only watching American programming. She obviously also talked about Australian screen stories. There are some on the streaming services, though. Colin from Accounts, for example, on Binge was hugely popular. Is it a question of they're not making enough? Is it a question of we're not watching it enough? Because it seems like when it's made, it does find an audience and it can be super popular, like Colin from Accounts, for example. But yet there is a feeling that it's not being made enough.
That's a really good point. I would counter that by saying our content is not discoverable enough. You know, the implication that once we impose an expenditure quota on the streaming services, we'll have this new, wonderful treasure trove of Australian titles on the interface is a bit misguided, because once they're made, we have no control over how they're promoted. So a lot of the research that I've done has looked at not just the availability of Australian titles in video demand catalogs, but how they're categorized, how searchable they are, how heavily they're promoted in kind of the prime real estate of the interfaces. And so that's something that the regulators have not even began to consider, and it's definitely the next frontier.
And in terms of discoverability, the fact that there are ever more players in the market must make it even harder. What happens next? Are we at saturation point now?
Yeah, it's a great question, especially with Max arriving on Monday. Well, clearly, the early speculation about Australia only having room for two services was misguided. We love streaming. I think the issue might be that once you start stacking so many subscriptions, these become almost as expensive as an old school Foxtel subscription. And so we have seen in the last couple of years, obviously during COVID, streaming went through the roof. But in the last couple of years, we've seen increases in cancellations, in downgrading to the ad tiers that you previously mentioned. And the interviewees that I've been speaking to have described how they will sign up to Netflix, do all of Netflix, cancel it after 3 months, and then watch all of Amazon Prime Video. So we are seeing an increased willingness and ability, I suppose, to churn between services as well, to make sure that you are able to see whatever current kind of water cooler cultural touchstone is on at the time.
Alexa, there was a time in the mid-2000s when I jumped on LimeWire and downloaded an episode of Alias, and it downloaded upside down, and we burned it onto a CD, a DVD, and then watched it on the television upside down. So desperate were we for the next installment of Alias. That was at a time when Australia was the piracy capital of the world. Maybe not everyone was watching content upside down, but they probably were engaging in similar practices. With things getting so expensive now, is piracy going to make a comeback? We've gotten used to paying for content, but it sounds like people are paying too much now, or they feel like they're paying too much.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Netflix and its cohort arrived and we just forgot about how willing and how normal it was to pirate up a storm. Every man and his dog was doing it, and we were the capital of Game of Thrones downloads in 2014. That's a really great point, and I think that we will see a return to piracy if we reach a point where to watch everything is just absolutely unsustainable. The research that I've been doing recently has pointed to some interesting new options that kind of legitimize streaming in a way, or at least provide a more legitimate experience of piracy, sorry. I've heard recently about how people are using Plex to download Up a Storm and then turn it into what looks like a really fancy and legitimate, their own streaming service is how they describe it. Along with piracy, I just want to point out that we might also start seeing some consolidation in the future, some big services gobbling up smaller or second tier services, and even big services coming together to pool their resources.
Dr. Alexa Scarlatta, that's where we have to leave it. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Right, Viv, any other business before we wrap up?
Well, Tim, the election has been called, which means
finally
we're probably going to see way more election ads.
Hurrah!
One of them's already caught my eye, though. It's the Labor Party, and bear with me here, using an AI-generated cartoon cat.
And why wouldn't you?
To highlight the apparent dangers faced by Medicare. The cats are meowing along to the sound of the Billie Eilish track, What Was I Made For?, while the viewer sees cats in various state of injury and distress, dressed in human clothing, being treated at the doctors and then coming across a newspaper that warns them that Medicare is at risk.
Is this a policy announcement, Medicare for cats?
Gosh, I bet there's a lot of pet owners there who wish that was the case. But no, there's no policy. It's a bit of a scare tactic, I guess, about what would allegedly happen under Peter Dutton if he was Prime Minister with Medicare. I'm not sure, though, that meow, 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 meow sells me that message effectively. It's not quite clear why AI has been used here, why we're using cats meowing over an American song, and what exactly they're trying to achieve with this ad.
Are we maybe just too old to understand the meme?
I think youths, young people, still need a message, they still need a point, and they still need good content. And I would argue that this is not good content, it doesn't have a point, and I'm confused by the message. So let us know what you think about AI cats spruiking Medicare, or what you're doing with your streaming habits. Are you going to try Max? Drop everything but iView. Email us at medialand@abc.net.au.
And speaking of emailers, hello to listener Graham, who emailed to ask me to stop saying toodle pip at the end.
Follow Medialand on the ABC Listen app. Thanks to our producer, Nat Tenchich. We'll catch you same time next week in your feeds and on Radio National. See you, Tim.
Toodle pip, Viv and Graham.